So this evening our speaker is Andrea Fella, who I'm sure many of you know. Andrea's been practicing insight meditation since 1996 and started teaching in 2003. She's particularly drawn to long, intensive retreat practice and has done that both here in the United States and in Burma. In fact, on one of her retreats, she ordained as a nun with Sayadaw Ujanaka. And most recently, she just returned from several months in Burma, where she was both on a meditation retreat and also managing a retreat over there. So, welcome.
Thanks, Jim. So, as many of you know, yesterday we had a memorial service here for Hilda Weisberg, one of our Sangha members, who died a week ago today. And she was a very dedicated practitioner and a very integral part of this community. And she offered her, the end of her life and her death, to the Sangha as a reflection, a meditation on death, really. I got to spend quite a bit of time with her in the last week of her life and watched her go through some of her process around approaching the end of life. And then after her death, she had requested in a kind of a formal, some traditions in Buddhism have a kind of a traditional 3-day period where the body is left where it died. And she requested that and requested also a vigil. And so members of the community went and sat by her side in the 3 days after her death. And it was a very moving and profound experience for all of those who had participated, I believe. On one of those days, there was a body washing, a ritual washing of the body. And everyone that I talked to that attended her after her death talked about how amazing it was and how meaningful it was. And then we had a small ceremony at her cremation that was quite lovely. So it really has been a week of, for many of us, really a reflection on death. And when death comes at us like this, where it's approached in such a meaningful way, we can take it in. It's a little bit easier to take in. Often we don't really take death in unless it makes itself impossible to ignore. You know, we read about death in the newspapers every day, about the number of people dying in Iraq and people killed in automobile accidents, people dying of disease. But it often doesn't really hit us. It doesn't really impact us. It comes in sort of a surface way, but not in a deep way, that every day, every moment, people are dying. In one Indian epic called the Mahabharata, there's a beautiful quote that I like. One of the characters is asked, "What is the greatest wonder?" And his reply is, "This, I think, is most wonderful, that the man of the world, even though he is seeing before his eyes constantly creatures dying and passing away, never for a moment the idea enters him, I too have to fall. I am also a creature destined to be destroyed. Even if it is told to him, it never enters his mind. Only the surface mind understands the language, but the actual sense never goes into his head." So this reflection on death is part, in Buddhist practice, is part of a larger reflection on impermanence. And that is what I'd like to talk about this evening, and how really deeply letting this in, this idea of impermanence, really letting it touch us, not just at the surface level, but really the actual sense of impermanence. It's not a depressing thing, actually. It actually leads to some very deep happiness and peace. So if you ask anybody on the street, do things change? They'll say yes. I mean, this is not news to us that things are impermanent, that things change. Everything changes. We know this. We see it all the time. We see children grow. They're born. They become children. They turn into teenagers and young adults. We see our own bodies age and deteriorate. We see friendships form and dissolve. We see this all the time. We see it in the seasons changing. It's not news. And yet, we don't really get it. It's hard to really, really understand this truth. The Buddhist texts say that there are four basic aspects of impermanence. Birth ends in death. Meeting ends in parting. Accumulation ends in dispersal. And rising ends in falling. And the texts say that that means both the rising of buildings and the decay of buildings, but also rising into power and falling from power. But as the text says in the Mahabharata, even though we know these, what I'm saying to you is not a surprise. I'm sure you all are familiar with all of these different kinds of impermanence. But typically, only the surface mind understands this. There are two basic aspects of impermanence that we can talk about. And one I'll call the gross level of impermanence. The other is what I'll call the subtle level of impermanence. The gross level is what we experience all the time. It's the obvious change in the world. It's that doesn't come to any surprise to us. Things come into being, last for a period of time, and then disappear. For example, a leaf that appears on a tree in spring lives its life during the summer and then falls from the tree in the autumn. So this is the obvious change in the world. And reflecting on this, really letting even this level in, is very powerful for our opening and our freeing of our heart. The subtle level is change that happens moment to moment. It's harder to see this kind of impermanence without really entering into a quiet space, without quieting the mind, stilling the mind in some kind of meditation. But actually everything is changing. I mean, physics tells us this. It's no surprise to us because, atoms are in constant flux. In fact, there aren't really even atoms. There's just all these particles forming and dissolving. But it's hard to experience that kind of impermanence. But there is a way in which we can touch into this moment-to-moment changing as we still and quiet our minds. So I'd like to talk about both of these levels of impermanence. So this gross level of impermanence is obvious to us when we even pay the least little bit of attention to the world. Some, of course, are just completely and dreadfully obvious, like the World Trade Center is falling down in a moment and thousands of people dying that day. Or on December 26, 2004, hundreds of thousands of people dying as the wave hit and swept across the Indian Ocean. Living here in California, most of us have experienced earthquakes, and that experience can be a pretty profound experience of really recognizing that, wow, even this earth is not stable. This feels pretty solid here, but when you experience an earthquake, it quickly starts to be, well, gee, even the earth itself is not stable. At one point, when I was on retreat, I began to tune into this kind of flowing, obvious change in my day, and it kind of began to surprise me at moments. I was a work retreatant on this particular retreat and participating in a lot of preparation in the kitchen. So I'd walk into the kitchen in the morning and there'd be a big pile of things to chop, things to, you know, cut up and prepare for the day. And so I'd chop, and then I'd come after the meal and I would see, you know, actually I would come before the meal and see the food as it's put out. So the food has now transformed and been prepared into food. And then after the meal, I noticed, wow, all the food is gone. Now it's been integrated into all these bodies. And it really kind of struck me. It's like, wow, that food this morning, just hours ago, was sitting on the counter. And I was chopping it with a knife. Now it's gone. It's part of somebody's body. It can be kind of startling when we actually take it in, what impermanence is. It's just something that is so commonplace. I think that's part of why we don't take it in, because it is so commonplace. We really don't experience the impact of the fact that things are ending all the time. So why is it important, actually, to really take in this sense of impermanence, this actual sense of impermanence? Much of our suffering in our life actually results from not really understanding this notion of impermanence. As one Buddhist scholar, Karunadasa is his name, as he put it, dukkha is but, that is the Pali word for suffering, dukkha. Dukkha is but a logical corollary arising from this law of universal impermanence. For the impermanent nature of everything can lead to but one inescapable conclusion. As everything is impermanent, they cannot be made the basis of permanent happiness. Whatever is transient is by that very fact unsatisfactory. So our suffering in our lives often results from clinging to some experience or thing that we think will make us happy. In fact, what we think we can do is figure out a way to arrange our lives so that one happy experience will follow another. And when we aren't successful at this, we think we've failed somehow, like that something is wrong with us because we haven't managed to arrange our life in this way. Rainer Maria Rilke expresses this kind of beautifully in his 8th Duino elegy. He says, "And we, spectators, always, everywhere, turned toward the world of objects, never outward. It fills us. We arrange it. It breaks down. We rearrange it, then break down ourselves. Who has twisted us around like this so that no matter what we do, we are in the posture of someone going away? Just as upon the farthest hill, which shows him his whole valley one last time, he turns, stops, lingers. So we live here, forever taking leave." It's not actually a mistake when we can't arrange our lives in that way. It's just the law of impermanence. One of the most profound ways to take this in, this obvious level, this gross level of impermanence, is to reflect on death. Not only our own death, but the death of friends, family. Reflect that everyone that we know, all of our closest friends, The younger people, the older people, all will die in no particular order. We don't know when it will happen, and it could happen at any moment. Carlos Castaneda wrote of his internship, apprenticeship with a Mexican, a very wise man. They called him a warrior. But anyway, Don Juan was his name. And Don Juan, in his early teachings to Castaneda, recommended this to him. He said, the thing to do when you are impatient is to turn to your left and ask advice from your deaf. An immense amount of pettiness is dropped if your deaf makes a gesture to you, or if you catch a glimpse of it, or if you just have the feeling that your companion is there watching you. And this is reflected in the Dhammapada in a very similar vein. Many do not realize that we here must die. For those who realize this, quarrels end. The Buddha recommended reflections on impermanence, not only just simply thoughtful reflections. In fact, there's one chant that encourages us to reflect on five subjects frequently. And of these five subjects for frequent recollection, four of them are around impermanence. I am of the nature to age. I have not gone beyond aging. I am of the nature to sicken. I have not gone beyond sickness. I am of the nature to die. I have not gone beyond dying. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. The fifth reflection has to do with how we are responsible for our own actions, and our happiness or unhappiness depends on our actions and our intentions. It's really helpful to regularly remind yourself of these kinds of impermanence. At one point, I posted this list on my bathroom mirror and looked at it every day. Even if you just take it in at the surface level every day, it will have a very slow and subtle impact on your life. When we do actually start to take in this impermanence, it does not need to be a depressing thing. It doesn't have to have a depressing impact on us. After Don Juan instructed Carlos Castaneda to use his deaf as an advisor, he didn't like this very much, and he responded that he thought it was useless to dwell on death since such a thought would only bring discomfort and fear. And Don Juan replied, you're full of crap. Death is the only wise advisor that we have. Whenever you feel that everything is going wrong and you're about to be annihilated, turn to your deaf and ask if that is so. Your deaf will tell you that you're wrong, and that nothing really matters outside of its touch. And later, Don Juan says, there's a strange consuming happiness in acting with the full knowledge that whatever one is doing may very well be one's last act on earth. I recommend that you reconsider your life and bring your acts into that light. This really resonates for me, this notion of this strange consuming happiness that can result from reflecting on death. As I more and more take in the fact that I am mortal, as I practice this practice and open to all of the impermanence of life, I find myself getting happier and happier. The impact and truth of impermanence can really open our hearts. We can start to act from what is most important to us in that looking at each act as though it's our last act on earth. We begin to clarify our priorities. We live in more in line with what our values are. And we begin to act more cleanly, more ethically. We're more careful with our actions in this way. We also begin to realize that this is not something that's just going to happen to us. This is a universal law of nature. We are all going to die. And that recognition that we are not alone and that everyone is struggling with this very same fear, essentially, can open our hearts to compassion and connect us to all beings. So Hilda really brought us a gift this past year, really, in her offering her death to us as a reflection. It's quite a beautiful, for me, it was quite a beautiful practice. At the less obvious level, there is this, what we might call subtle impermanence, a very rapid changing that occurs moment to moment. We need to kind of quiet our minds a little bit. And even when we start in meditation, it can be difficult to see. But even if we just reflect a little bit on what's happening to us in our meditation, we can notice impermanence, even those of you who are just beginning. So the first thing most people notice when they sit down to meditate is that you decide you've chosen some object to pay attention to, like the breath, and you notice that that decision to stay with the breath is impermanent. Your mind wanders. So when you come back to it, you recognize, oh, it's time to come back. But that is a example of impermanence. But over time, as we get a little more skilled with the meditation, we can actually manage to stay with a little more consistency on a particular object. So we can stay with the breath for longer periods of time. And then we can start to see that that object itself is changing. If you're paying attention to the rising and falling of the breath, it's pretty clear. There's a beginning, a middle, an end of the in-breath. There's often a little gap, a moment of pause. Then there's a beginning, a middle, an end of the out-breath. And these come and go over and over again, rising, falling, rising, falling. There's impermanence in every single breath. And as you bring even a little more close attention, if you bring your attention right into the actual sensations, what are the sensations of the in-breath? You'll notice that there's not anything stable about those either. There's a continual flux and flow of pressure and pulsing and movement. No experience lasts for very long. And then sometimes we open up to all experience and not just focus ourselves on a single object. And we just take in with open awareness the stream, the flow of life. And in that experience, the awareness is able to stay present, but we just see how different objects come into awareness one after another. A moment of sound, a moment of thought, a moment of pressure, a moment of vibration, a moment of heat, a moment of thought again. There's just this continual flux of experience. Sometimes this flux, seeing this flux of experience, can be surprising. And the way we experience it can surprise us. For example, one of the clearest ways this comes as a surprise to many of us is when we start to be able to pay attention to physical pain in our bodies, in our meditation. And when we're not resisting the pain, if we have a pain in our knee, for example, if we're not resisting it, we can see, we can bring our attention in and see that it is just a rapidly changing dance of moving sensations. And if you try to figure out where is the pain actually, you know, land the mind right on where it is, you can't do it. It's moving so rapidly that you cannot pin it down. And at one point, sometimes you can actually see a very rapid alternation of the pain being there and then poof, disappearing. And a moment of no pain. And then it comes back and then it disappears. So there's this alternation, pain, no pain, pain, no pain, pain, no pain. At one point, when I was experiencing this in my meditation, I realized that any movement of aversion in the mind to actually want to get rid of the pain covered over those moments of no pain. That when there was any kind of aversion to the pain, I actually missed that half the time the pain wasn't there. And in those moments of no pain, there was great relief. So letting go of the aversion to pain could bring great feeling of relief, even in the experience of the pain coming and going. So when we are in our meditation, it's pretty easy to see as we pay attention that our bodily experience is impermanent. But not only that, our mental experience, everything we experience in our mind is impermanent. Thoughts, moods, feelings, perceptions, ideas, views. They are actually coming and going far more rapidly than the physical sensations are. This belief in permanence, the belief that things are solid, which most of us have to some extent, is caused by not seeing things as they actually are. Impermanence is masked by two things, I think. One is by the rapidity of change, the fact that things are changing so fast that we just don't see that they're changing. And that's true when we're at a kind of a normal level of attention and we're paying attention to something like pain. The pain is changing so fast that we just don't really see that it's changing. An analogy for this can be in the thinking about how a movie works, you know, the standard version of a film as opposed to a digital disc. And you've got these frames, these individual frames, and they're just these still frames. And there's nothing really there. But when you put it in front of a light and move it very rapidly, you don't see the breaks between the frames. And what you see projected is that something looks like it's continuous. So it's kind of similar in our experience. The change is happening so fast that it appears continuous. The other piece, I think, is that the mind is kind of designed to hold on to perception for a period of time. And I really understood this at one point when I went to the Exploratorium. And it was about maybe 6 or 7 years ago, and I don't know if the exhibit is still there, but I walked into the Exploratorium with my nephew. He was 10 years old at the time. And at the back of the Exploratorium, there were these bars hanging from the ceiling. They were, you know, maybe 3 or 4 feet long and spaced about every 4 feet. And they had flashing lights on them, different colors of flashing lights. And I looked up at those and thought, huh, that's interesting. I wonder what that is. And just wandered around with my nephew in the Exploratorium for a period of time. And we had made reservations for the tactile dome, and we were getting some refreshment before going in and sitting down just outside the area where these bars were. And my nephew looked up and said, oh, it's a school bus. And I looked up and I saw a bunch of yellow flashing lights. And I thought, huh, well, I kind of see that it's the right color for a school bus, but I don't see a school bus. And, you know, we didn't have time at that moment to really check it out for me. And he's just, oh, and now it's butterflies. Wow, look at that. And I'm going, what? What are you seeing? And we went into the tactile dome and had a great time in there and came out. And I turned to those bars and I said, okay, now let me see this. You know, what is going on here? And he was proclaiming what things were passing by. And at some point, it's kind of, you know, like a trick almost of how you have to move your eyes. But at some point, my eyes moved at just the right speed, and I could exactly see what he was talking about. There was a school bus there, and it turned into what those bars turned into was like a big screen, essentially. And you could watch the movement of the school bus. It was like the school bus was driving by in the air. And all that was happening was that these lights were flashing on these bars. And my understanding is that there's just a series of flashing lights that the mind holds onto and carries, essentially. The mind is carrying those images through the air. And then at the right, if you're moving your eyes at the right speed, it will pick up at the next bar. And the light will be flashing properly there to carry the image forward. It's quite amazing to see how much the mind can construct. So this is a very valuable thing, I mean, that we hold on to perceptions. It's kept us alive as a species, I'm sure. You know, if we experienced our world as broken bits of information, we wouldn't live very long. But broken bits of information is kind of the base level of our experience. And when we cling to what we construct in our minds through this perceptual process, we suffer. Observe anything that you think of as solid, and eventually you'll start to see it break down. Any solid bodily sensation. For example, your hand. Bring your hand in front of you for a moment. Your hand looks pretty solid. I mean, feels pretty solid. But close your eyes and just experience hand. You may feel tingling, vibration, pulsing, quivering. And now bring your attention to the sensation. You can put your hand down. Bring your attention to the sensation of where your butt contacts the floor or your cushion or the chair. It feels pretty solid at first. But let your attention come into it. See if you can find where the strongest point of contact is. And what do you feel there? Throbbing? Pulsing? Vibration? All these sensations are the markers of change. You can open your eyes. And in our minds, we think our mental habits and patterns are solid because they appear so frequently. We think they're lurking somewhere down there all the time, that when they're not there, they're actually there somewhere. For me, I took this before I started doing a lot of practice. I thought of myself as a miserable person. And you know, that's how I experienced my life a lot, was through that miserable person, that miserable persona. And when I was happy, I kind of had the belief, it's like, well, yeah, I'm happy now, but what I really am is a miserable person. So I just really didn't let it in. You know, it's like I really felt like that miserable person was lurking somewhere, just waiting, that the happy persona was temporary, but the miserable persona wasn't. Observe what it is you take to be yourself. You might find that it's simply a familiar pattern of contraction in your body and thoughts in your mind and moods, emotions. And we have a bunch of these that we're familiar with. Like there's the angry me. There's the contented me. There's the satisfied me. There's the self-righteous me. There's the wanting me. There's the bored me. And we're familiar with the way these things feel. And because of that, we think it all is me. But if you observe anything in your experience, any mood, any thought, anything you're taking to be yourself, what you will notice is that it changes. There's nothing consistent about it. And in fact, our notion of who we are is built on top of very basic things happening, this process of knowing, of perception, of feeling. Very basic processes happening in the very, you know, just contacting sense experience. The very bare experience is turned into knowing, perception, and feeling in our experience. And that's the bare experience. And what we consider self is built on top of those things. And those things that it's built on top of is that all of those things, the contact with sense experience, the contact with what comes in the eye, the contact with what comes in the ear, the contact with whatever we think, all of those things are impermanent. And the self that we constructed on top of them has to be impermanent because what causes it is impermanent. If you just look at your experience yourself, you'll see the truth of this. It's not really necessary to believe this. In fact, with much of Buddhist practice, it's not necessary to believe anything except for it's worth paying attention to my experience. That is worth putting our trust in. It's worth paying attention to our experience and seeing what is happening. If you really pay attention to your experience, you'll find that nothing lasts for very long. And deeply seeing this leads us to freedom. When we see the impermanence of the world outside of us, when we really understand that everything is disappearing, everything is decaying, it helps us to let go of expecting things to be in a certain way. But the more deeply we explore our experience, the more we actually start to see that we aren't really clinging to what's out there, but rather we're clinging to what's constructed in our minds. We're clinging to an idea of something that's out there. It's a reflection of something that's out there. That's what we're actually clinging to. And when we see that we're clinging to something that's a reflection, think of a mirror and think of a reflection. There's nothing there, really. When we see that we're clinging to a reflection, and we really understand that the suffering happens because we're clinging to something that doesn't even really exist, the mind will just let go of that clinging. And it can open into a very, very deep sense of peace and freedom. I'd like to end this talk by reading a couple of paragraphs from an essay called The Walk in the Woods by Pra Kantipalo. This is his conclusion of this essay. Everything in everybody, that includes you and me, deteriorates, ages, decays, breaks up, and passes away. And we, living in the forest of desires, are entirely composed of the impermanent. Yet our desire impels us not to see this, though impermanence stares us in the face from every single thing around. And it confronts us when we look within, mind and body, arising and passing away. So don't turn on the TV, go to the pictures, read a book, see some food, or 100 other distractions just to avoid seeing this. This is the one thing really worth seeing, for one who fully sees it in himself is free. So we have a couple of minutes if there's any comments or questions.
If you happen to live long enough, it becomes pretty real, because people that you've known for a long, long time, including maybe since you were quite young, you know, are doing it. They are suffering sickness and yes. End of life and death. And my husband and I live several days a week in a continuing care place where the average age in the dining room is in the 80s somewhere. And it's amazing how jolly those people are. You know, they can be very wry about the whole thing, yeah. and yet they see people dying all the time. And I do too. I know two people I've known very, very well who are at the end of their lives right now. So, you know, there's no guarantee that you'll live that long, but I think it gets a little easier.
I think you're right. And in fact, sometimes one thing Gil says is that our meditation practice, I mean, age brings wisdom. You know, the longer we live, there is more wisdom that comes through the simple fact of aging. And Gil sometimes likes to say that meditation practice is accelerated aging. You know, we get to have some of that wisdom come a little sooner in our lives. So, yeah. So it's... Oh. It's nine, but one last thing.
In the quote you read at the end, you said something like, our desire keeps us from seeing this. So what is desire?
Desire is like the movement before that actual clinging. It's like that movement to say, I want. And that
if
movement...
If you looked at it, like... The way you look at pain, if you looked at it, would it sort of crumble into little component parts, this I want thing?
Yes. Yes, you can look at the I want also, and it crumbles up too. If you actually bring attention to desire itself, that is one of the best ways to practice with it, and you'll see that it too is impermanent. And it's one of the most beautiful ways to experience a desire, because when we see that desire is impermanent, we feel in the moment of the ending of desire, in that moment that it ends, it feels like we're released from a vice grip. And we realize that the happiness doesn't necessarily come from getting what we want. It comes from the ending of the desire. And it's a really, really lovely practice to explore. Yeah, thank you for mentioning that. Mm-hmm. The last bit? Sure, I'll read it and then we should end. Everything in everybody, that includes you and me, deteriorates, ages, decays, breaks up, and passes away. And we, living in the forest of desires, are entirely composed of the impermanent. Yet our desire impels us not to see this, though impermanence stares us in the face from every single thing around. And it confronts us when we look within, mind and body, arising and passing away. So don't turn on the TV, go to the pictures, read a book, see some food, or 100 other distractions just to avoid seeing this. This is the one thing really worth seeing, for one who fully sees it in himself is free. So thank you for your attention.